Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are warned that the following podcast program may contain stories, names and voices of deceased persons.
This is Outback Out Loud.
People and stories from Outback New South Wales.
The most amazing little town there could ever be. I love it.
I left to come out west and I came out Jillaroo-ing at Warren. And from there, that's where I started my love affair again with the Western Plains, and I've never left Western Plains from there.
It's a great little spot to live.
You know, just everything about Louth I love.
Just home as far as I'm concerned.
Outback Out Loud!
That's what I like.
Welcome to Outback Out Loud.
In this season, we explore stories and life experiences from the most remote centres in New South Wales.
Let's hear more from historian Dr. Mary-Ann Jebb about Quambone.
Bushranging touched the country around Quambone in the 1860s and 1870s. Though the village itself was only a small pastoral outpost and a track crossing the edge of the Macquarie Marshes at that time. Bushrangers such as Ben Hall's gang and later Captain Thunderbolt, Fred Ward, operated across the Western Plains, using the open country to move quickly and evade police. They occasionally stuck up stations, travellers and mail coaches on the rough bush tracks that passed near Quambone. Stories of raids and hold-ups on the western roads became part of local folklore. Aboriginal trackers attached to the Coonamble Police often played a key role in pursuing offenders through the plains and river country. In the 1860s, Captain Thunderbolt, Fred Ward, ranged widely across northern New South Wales. Local folklore tells of him and his companions moving down towards the Quambone side of the Macquarie Marshes, using the dense reed beds and flood channels as cover. Aboriginal trackers were essential in following horse tracks across the open plain, often recovering stolen animals from the marsh country. At its most populated in the 1950s and 70s, Quambone Village and District together supported from 400 to 500 people. This included not only the few dozen houses in the village, but also families living on surrounding properties, plus seasonal workers such as shearers, fencers and farmhands. The Aboriginal population remained significant, with families living both in the village and on nearby reserves or station camps, contributing labour to shearing and station work. As agriculture mechanised and farm sizes consolidated, the number of resident workers fell. By 1980s, the school roll had dropped sharply, businesses closed, and Quambone settled into the very small village it is today.
I'm Dougal Bucknell, husband of Justine Bucknell, quite obviously. My family's been at Quambone since 1912, but I was actually born down near Corinda in the core of the marshes on a house that had about 12-foot stilts to keep it out of the water. But then we moved back up to Quambone, and I've been there ever since. Originally, the property was 360,000 acres, but over the generations, it's been cut back down, and agriculture is our game.
10 years, roughly, before we were married, I was hanging out at the Oak at Double Bay and good friends with Dougal's sister, and that's how I met Dougal. And we started going out a little while after that. I still had a job in Sydney as a rep for, well, several years. We were going out for 10 years and before married. So that's how we met, in Sydney in a pub. And my job allowed me, because I was travelling the state, allowed me to go and visit Quambone reasonably often. And so that worked quite well. Well, the first time I drove out to Quambone was for Dougal's sister's 21st and Dougal's 25th. It was a joint party, and the road to Quambone was still partially dirt. We were heading west in October on a 40 degree day, and I thought, where the f*** am I going?
Quambone was a great area to grow up. Back then, the marshes hadn't been greatly affected by irrigation upstream, and so even though there was changes happening, it was still within the range of normal. It was just more at the dry end, but we got a sense of what the marshes were like, and people still had marsh blocks in the nature reserve. So some families who had small landholdings leased a block of the marshes, which was their drought reserve. And that's how the marshes and the dry land worked, that when the marshes were wet, obviously they were too deep in water, so you couldn't basically run livestock there. But when you went into a drier time, the marshes would dry out at the same time as the dry, higher country. And so people would then move their stock down into the marsh country. So there was continuous movement of stock, you know, and especially the marshes are best in summer. In winter, they get very cold and everything gets frosted. So people would walk their cattle down to the marshes in September, October, when the couches all starting to grow and the reeds are growing and everything like that, and the spring flush of water came through from up around Bathurst and Oberon and that sort of thing. And the snow water, there's whenever it snowed, say around Orange and that sort of thing, that water was different to normal rainwater. It was cooler and clearer, and brought different elements in it, you know, whether it was nitrogen or whatever. You know, everyone realised it was different. And so that used to happen. And then when you came around to the other end of the summer, when you're going into winter and it was starting to get colder, as things got frosted, people would pick their cattle up and take them back out. And by that stage, there'd be fat bullocks and fat, you know, everything would be rolling fat. And so there'd be all the saleable cattle would be taken off and sold. And that's sort of how the system worked.
So I explain it as Macquarie River flows down. This was my initial understanding. It spreads out into this marsh country, and it just... It acts as a filter. It actually acts as a filter. So this water actually flows through the marshes, and then does it join the Macquarie River before it joins the Barwon?
Yes.
At that end? And it just seems to be like a haven for bird life, frogs, fish. So it's a whole, besides being a carbon sink, it's actually has a hugely important function in sustaining ecology, nature, in the environment. So it really has a hugely important purpose, hence parts of it being listed as a Ramsar wetland of international importance, which is it has unique qualities.
And there's international agreements that Australia has, so with other countries. So there's Jamba, Camber, Rock Amber. So Jamba is Japanese, Australian Migratory Birds Agreement. Canberra is one with the Chinese, and Rockhampton is the one with the Republic of Korea, about migratory birds. Each country that signs up, we have birds that come to us from their countries, and they go back each year.
They're actually counted.
Yes, oh. And so we have responsibilities there, international agreements that we've signed up to. One of my best days, a long time ago, I was probably 8 or 9, I suppose, something like that. We're down at Gidgera, a place we used to own down near Corinda. Miltara Gauge is there. And this is where the house with 12-foot stilts and a big, great big levee bank where I was born. Dad and I used to walk out there and walk back into the reed bed, and you'd walk in and out of channels for 4 or 5 kilometres. And the channels would be full of reed and maybe only 20 metres wide. And then you come out into a dry area, and slowly you got more and more channels and less dry area. Then we got to the back of Gidgera, which was a place called Never Dry, which was also part of our families at one stage. And the reeds were there, all the common reeds. And you'd get out there and you'd be waist deep in water, just on waist deep, the same height as a wooden fence post. And Dad would pick me up on top of it. There was only a few wooden fence posts left in this very, very old fence. And Dad would pick me up on top of the wooden fence posts, and I'd stand there, and we'd pull all the leeches off that got on us by that stage. And that wasn't much fun, but anyway. Then we'd hop back into the water, all the time being as quiet as we could, so we didn't splash. We just placed ourselves into the water. Then you'd walk through the last of the reed, and there'd be bits of gaps where the water was a bit deeper. And then you'd go out through there. Now, on the other side of the reed, there'd be clear water for probably 500 or 600, maybe 800 metres till the reed on the other side started, and you were doing the reverse on the other side. And so you'd get to this clear water and you'd sneak out there without making a splash. You'd probably only get 10 or 15 metres out there, and you could look upstream and downstream for probably a kilometre, and then the water waved around a bend and went the other way. And then all of a sudden there'd be a squawk of some little bird or a duck or a swan or something or other that took fright, and there'd be just this eruption of birds from 10 metres away, then 50 metres away, then 100 metres away, then 200 metres away, all lifting off away from you. And the more that lifted, the more noise there was, and the more birds that lifted. And it was just turned what was a blue sky into a bird sky. And they'd fly around you. If you didn't get pooped on, it was just amazing. But it was just one of those things. It was just astounding.
My name's Larry Garnsey, and I live in Quambone, or out of Quambone, 5 kilometres out on the Warren Road. And I've been in Quambone all bar 5 years of my life. Parents lived here when they were young. And my father's parents lived at Crinda, the other side of Crinda, and we lived there for 5 years, and we moved back to Quambone. My grandparents on mum's side, they lived opposite out where we live on the creek, and they used to ride their horses into school. That's what they did. And then in the latter years, they moved into Quambone. Some of their brothers and sisters have bought places at Corinda and at Canamble, so that family scattered, and then Mum's family lived here, Mum's mother and father. I knew Margaret years ago through Polycross, her and her ex-husband, so we knew each other all. And then they got divorced, Margaret and I, and got married in 1995.
Oh,
you know. So, we she had 4 kids, little kids, so, and then we had 2. So we've raised them. They're scattered all over Australia at the moment. Oh, one's in France, so. Had a bit of a go of farming, but we didn't do any good at that, cropping and that, so we give that away. So we just, work the sheep and cattle and maintaining the place. And I hated sheep, but I had them because you basically had to have them. But now I don't mind them. They're a bit easier to manage these days with the chemicals that got out. I can work cattle on my own. We're sheep, I can do that, but I'm starting to get, I need someone to help me now. Get a bit old. About 1,200 mean merino breeding ewes, 61 cows, but we're building the cows up. So, whereas we had more sheep, then the drought struck, so we're just trying to build up from there. We put adjustment cattle on, so if someone owns them, we take them on, then they pay per head per week for those cattle to be on our place. So, at the moment, we've got a lot of adjustment cattle on, and we're just trying to build up our numbers slowly. Buy a few at a time, pay them off, and buy a few more. So. I basically have merinos because we have first cross lambs. So we buy borderless to rams and put them over the merino ewe. So the wool side of it for us is just another, like a sideline, added value sort of thing. Whereas the lamb's what I want out of them, like the crossbred lamb. And at the moment, they're bringing big money. We haven't got the fences at the moment to hold dorpers or any of those exotic breeds because they just run straight through a fence, whereas merinos basically stay inside a reasonable fence. Merinos are pretty, they'll stay at home. We sold our lambs last year from the time they were born, by the time they'd left the place, they were 4 months old, and we averaged $120 a lamb for them, and they're only little fellas, some of them. When you're growing up, Dad would say, and was the teacher along the track. Just when you went and worked for someone, wherever it was, you learn a bit from one person, and then you take that on board, and then someone else will teach you something else. Oh, that's a good idea, so you do that. So there's probably a lot of people where you picked up bits and pieces of ideas where you could implement them if you thought they suited you. We've got some young ones around here now. If you want to work, you ring them up and book them up for day or 2 days. Some people these days advertise themselves, but back years ago, everyone around here knew that you were there and you'd done it, and they'd ring you up. So you're basically, even though you're only casual, nearly might be 2 days here and 3 days there, and then the next week, you know, 4 days here and 1 day there, and you might go for a month or two, then you mightn't do anything for a week, and then you're going again. So I was always away years ago. I'd come home and I'd have a week at home, and then away I go again. So people that lived here years ago were probably more isolated out on the places than now, because you got reliable, or supposed to be reliable, phone services. And in those days, they had mail. The mail would drop the mail off. Whereas these days, I think you've got to come to town to get it, I'm not sure. So, but I've spent a lot of time at home now, trying to get that going. Whereas I could put cattle in a yard or a paddock, whatever, before on my own. And now if they break, I'm a bit slower on the bike getting around them. So I'm trying to build some new holding yards and lanes and that type of thing where I can contain the cattle a bit easier. Well, that'll take me a while. So once I do that, I'll be right. Prepare for when I'm 80. That's my goals.
So my name's Pip Fisher. I am a teacher at Quamboan Public School. Quamboan is a small town about 2 hours northwest of Dubbo in New South Wales. And yeah, I actually don't know what the population is at the moment. I think maybe 50. That obviously includes people who live in town and then a lot of farmers out of town. I was born in Sydney, but moved to Armidale in New South Wales, a regional town, much bigger than Quamboan, but still a regional town. And I went to primary school there at a small school, which, again, not as small as this, but I really enjoyed that small school experience, and I think that's one of the reasons I love teaching here. And then my family moved to Hobart, so I went to high school in Hobart, and then I went to university in Armidale, and I did a year teaching in Newcastle for my first year before moving out to here, and I've taught at Quamboan and Canamble in my teaching career out here. I first moved out here in 2009, so getting close to that 20 years mark now. I've been teaching for nearly 20 years now. And I came out here because my sister was teaching out here. I'd already done a prac out here before, and I'd visited while my sister was living here and teaching here. That's how I knew about it, and I loved the community and the area. I met a farmer who lives out here and passed further out, so it was much more convenient for me to work at Quamboan. When I first came out to Quamboan and Canamble, I feel like there was an influx of young farmers, and then at the same time, a lot of teachers and nurses coming to the area, as they always do. So it was a really great social life when I was first here in my 20s. And, you know, there was always sporting events, music events, country races, just people having cook-offs and all sorts of things, you know, just having a great time. And that's really what kept me here, is the lots of young people, lots of entertainment, lots of friends, yeah, lots to do. I think everybody would just go out together, and we just got to know each other that way. I'd already met him because his mother is also a teacher, and when I had come and done a prac here, she invited me out to dinner on the farm. So I'd already met him a few years previously. So we started a friendship, and obviously grew from there, just from the social life at the time. I always envisaged myself teaching in country New South Wales. That was what I wanted to do. I don't know whether I thought I'd settle so quickly in one spot and now be here for the rest of my life. But that's also great too, you know, and it's a wonderful experience living on a farm, and it obviously has its challenges. There's still plenty of opportunity. Getting to participate in the Canamble and the Cats, the amateur theatre group, and do the plays and things there, which the acting side of that is a little bit more scary for me. I'm not very good at that, I don't think, but I love the singing and the dancing aspect of it, and again, just that community spirit and everyone just wanting to have a go, and which is so much fun. So yeah, and then yeah, it's just what everybody else does, and sings in the shower and while you're cooking and all the rest of it, but it definitely gives me a lot of joy. It's amazing how many people you talk to when you are travelling around the country. Well, I mean, I'm on this side of the country, who know Quambone, considering its size. And I feel like there are so many things out here that that people don't even know about, like the Macquarie Marshes, which are, you know, apparently an internationally renowned wetland. And I didn't know about them until I moved out here. And then just the small town spirit and community. People just like to get involved. And we've got the Polo Cross are a great group too. They have Martha Guy races here, which apparently used to be massive back in the day. You know, just everybody getting together at the pub and it being a community base where you can bring the kids and they have a great time. It's a great little spot to live.
Throughout the 80s, a local resident built a full movie theatre in their house. Here's Larry and Cheryl's memories of it.
Neville Mercer, over here, he had movies too when that shut down in his home over here.
That's right, he had movies too.
He built that home straight across, over there actually.
Yes.
And he had at the back, he built a little room, as big as this, not as big as this. With a, and he had, we, I think the Mansion Snowy River was the first time I seen it there.
And, I never got to see any of them there. That movie theatre was shut down by 1990. Yeah. But yeah, I've heard a lot of people talk about it. Yeah.
So people would pay money.
Yeah, he had it in his home there. So they'd pay the money, and we had the Mansion. There was a few movies we watched. I know the Mansion Snowy was one, but we watched a few there, and I think it held about 15, 20 people. But you had to book ahead, obviously, so, to get into it. It just went in and watched the movie, and then most just went around the pub then. So.
That it was a full decked out picture theatre inside with and have all the latest movies. It would get the movies out here before they'd see them in Sydney or anywhere. They'd be advertised in the school paper, or there'd be a note up at the shop, or you'd get a brochure in your mail. It might have been $10 a movie. It had all floor seats and everything in it, big screen up the front, all air conditioned. And then he'd have a meal, like finger food and that, the some occasions. Might have been one a month or when something new came out. Yeah. And the guy that owned it, he was actually an electrician himself, Neville Mercer. That was his name. He built a house, but he built the house, the living part, around the picture theatre part. You had like a big room like they have in a picture theatre, and you have the room up the back where the cameras come through, and it was like an elite thing for the town. Like he came dressed up with your glasses of wine and stuff before you... movie theatre before you went to the pictures. It was like, for the time and for to be out here, it was exclusive. Because like I said, he had the movies out here before they went to Sydney or were released anywhere like that. So he obviously had friends somewhere. But years ago, apparently, before we came here, there used to be another, they used to have movies down on the corner of the main street, but I wasn't here when they were on. We came here after that.
Here's Dave, who hangs out at the Sundowner Hotel.
What made you come to Quambone?
Well, that's a good question. Well, I don't know. I seen the advertised positions on a big station. So I rang up and, yes, interview, start straight away. Sandy Camp. All mustering horses there.
Where do you live now, Dave?
5 mile out. End up buying 1,580 acres.
What's your best memory in Quambone?
When I first came here, the old pub used to be just up there. And they built this one. When did they? Hey, Rob, when did they build the pub here? Do you remember?
Early 60s.
The old pub used to be there. And yeah. They dismantled the RSL club in Canamble and built this one here.
What was the old pub like? Can you describe that?
Old weatherboard pub. A long while ago. It used to be a sawmill just here too. Years ago. Gee, was a bloody bit. They used to employ up to 16 on the sawmill. They used to fight every bloody weekend, didn't they? There were three brothers.
What were they cutting? Pine?
Yeah. All bloody pine. Part of that. No, I'm not. I don't come from Cornwall.
Where do you come from?
Gundagai. You know, down south.
Yeah, well, the dog sat on the tucker box.
That is right. My wife, and I come up here with a wife and two dogs and a ute.
You're only having a Diet Coke now. When did you stop drinking?
Did you hear? Oh, shit. No. Yeah, 56 years ago, I think. Anyhow, I woke up one morning. I'm never going to have another beer. And unless I have a 5 ounce with a shearer at Cobar.
Thanks for listening. To hear more amazing stories from Outback New South Wales, check out the whole Outback Out Loud series, now streaming everywhere.
We acknowledge and celebrate the first Australians on whose traditional lands we meet and work, and whose cultures are among the oldest continuing cultures in human history.
Please like, subscribe, rate us, and write a review. The Outback Out Loud podcast was designed and produced by Signal Creative.
Season 4 of Outback Out Loud has been made by Outback Arts. You can find Outback Arts at outbackarts.com.au or on Facebook and Instagram. This season was made possible with funding support from the Regional Arts Fund. On-ground support this season came from Marnie Vaughan and Andrew Hull. Outback Out Loud Season 4 was researched, consulted, recorded and edited by Emma Hoy. Thank you to everyone who's been involved over the last 5 years.